Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
And that's
Brian,
it.
I'm going to get things started right away here.
Yeah, man, let's just jump right in. I didn't really have a topic lined up. But I know that stuff that's on our minds. You know what? Can we talk about, you know, one of the things that we do in After Things is we sort of peel back the veneer over our public personas and talk a little more about the difficulties of trying to make it in our respective entertainment businesses and getting ahead, making
score,
art.
I did say I had a topic, just so you know. Okay, Brian, please go ahead.
Wait, you did have a topic?
Yes, I said I did. But so please go ahead. Talk. Okay. You're already peeling back the veneer. You've already got a lead. You got to go with this now.
Well, I don't know. I'm currently preoccupied thinking about health-related stuff and about how I've sort of it's very weird for me. When I was touring, just life was touring, and however my health was nothing I could affect. When I was home, I could work out, and the rest of the time, I had to eat whatever was available and work out if I happen to have an hour free. But now that it's sort of like, you know, a few weeks at home, then go out for a week to do a TV thing in Vegas, then come back or whatever, I'm really excited about the opportunity to get consistent results and see where stuff's headed. Last time we talked about this topic, I guess, was a month ago, and I was talking about all the crazy vegetables I was eating, and I still go to that, but when I'm on the road, it's nice to, in that environment, have permission to eat whatever, whenever, and then come back home and then get back to the grind, and I'm in a weird place where it feels really, really good.
You know, anytime you exercise control over what you're doing, anytime that you make a conscious effort and you decide to change something and you see a result, it is very affirming. It's one of these things that you want to pursue more and more. And then often we get into situations where we then kind of get out of it. Like, I will get into these kicks where I'll be, you know, get healthy, but then I'll go get, you know, go to a convention or something like that. And I have, you know, my immune system is like for nothing. I mean, I'm such a loner. I'm never exposed to these things. So I get sick, I get out of it, and then I forget to go do it. But when you do get on top of stuff, like, I've only been eating like one meal a day the last 4 or 5 days, partially because I'm sick, but now I'm liking it because, you know, I mean, the weight's been coming off and I'm like, oh, this is cool. Like, you know what? I used to do that a long time ago. You know, when I weighed the least as an adult, like, I only ate like once a day, and like, oh, I'm gonna go try that again.
And you, it was you that forwarded me that book or that article on how long it takes to get unhealthy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was an interesting article about how quickly you can get out of shape, which is a couple weeks. But the converse of that is when I started doing my workout routine, I saw within a week I was getting back gains that had taken me months before to put together. So that's the upside about that, is you can lose it quickly, but if you get back in with high intensity, it doesn't take you as long to get to where you were.
Man, and I'll tell you what, like, you know, last year, because we had the TV thing, I got pretty fit. I still haven't seen 142 again, which is in my I'm still 30 mindset, mm-hmm. You know, is where I think I belong. But I did get down to 145, and the difference was, you know, I remember in January watching the footage, which was shot during the summer, and I'm like, holy crap, I used to be fit. I'm a slob now because I was, you know, 10 pounds heavier. And then, you know, I don't know. I'm two-thirds of the way back there. It's a long slog to get back in tip-top because you get those diminishing returns, right? There's a certain level at which you can't, you know, you have bones and you have water in your body and you can't plow through those borders.
Yeah, and you can certainly, you know, if you really have to absolutely need to, you know, radically lose weight, it's very, very doable. But if you're trying to make a lifestyle change, that's not the same path you want to take. You know, if like, you know, I'm like, Brian, we got a grudge. Next week, next Sunday, I'm knocking on your door and we're fighting mano a mano, you know, nothing you can do. Richard Garriott's got $1 million on the line. You know, you'll find a way to get in shape.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know. Plus also, and this is something that Freakonomics did a whole episode on, was talking about the synergistic way that you can tie short-term pleasures to stuff that normally you don't like to do, you know, and they did experiments where you listen to an audiobook while you work out, and people found mm-hmm. that it's like once they tied the experience of getting that story along with working out, people got really excited about working out. And I know for me,
while you do your taxes, it's a TurboTax recommendation, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and for me, I know that almost all of the playing of the crack-like Hearthstone that I do is on a stationary bike. And so it's like I get really excited about an hour to 2 hours of just sitting down and riding a bike, which, of course,
I lost like 6 pounds walking, listening to how Star Wars conquered the universe because I didn't want to go in. I just wanted to keep walking around the neighborhood.
Well, and when you move, I didn't realize this until I saw you down at Star Wars Celebration. Like when you walk, maybe it's the few extra inches you have on me vertically, but like you move fast. You don't mess around on your walks.
Oh yeah, I'm a fat. Yeah, but you know, it's that, you know, thinking fast, thinking slow. They talk about that optimum sort of speed. When like I have my speed, if I go faster, then I can't think slower, and then I'm going too slow. But for sure, I want to touch upon a sort of a thought, and kind of it's a crystallization of an approach that I've been developing, and that is, I've had some things magically that I've been working on. I've got a new magic book I'm working on, but then like first for my own act, I've got some things I've been developing, and I've had some stuff that I'm like, oh, you know, I'm interested in this sort of stuff. And the dancing handkerchief is a trick that fascinates me because it's, you know, when something comes alive and it moves around, it's neat. It's not a levitation per se. Maybe use similar magical technologies, but really it's supposed to be the animation of an object that becomes alive. And as a storyteller, I love this.
Well, and plus also from a practical standpoint, it's fascinating because there are so many different ways you could do it, which means you can take different handkerchiefs, each one using a different method, and all ostensibly being the same handkerchief. One can use one method to animate itself, and then later you can disprove that method because now it's, you know, there's been a replacement and it's another method.
You get in compound methods and all that. And so I was at the Magic Castle last Sunday, and I wanted to do some research into it. And as I'm walking through the Magic Castle through the lobby, I run into a guy by the name of Raymond Crow. Are you familiar with Raymond Crow, the Australian magician?
No, I'm not.
Raymond Crow is amazing. He calls himself an unusualist. He was one of the – did really, really well on Australia's Got Talent. He was part of the Illusionist Tour. He does a combination of magic, mime. He does – Hand Shadows. He does Hand Shadows to It's a Wonderful World, which is an amazing sort of piece. I highly recommend you type in Raymond Crow. It's Crow spelled C-R-O-W-E. And he's got some amazing handlings on stuff. He has a routine that he does called the Naked Zombie Ball. In magic, there's an effect called the Zombie, invented by a guy named Joe Carson, where the silver ball floats behind this phallard and in front and moves around. And there's a method to do this. There's a secret magic technology to do this. And Raymond Crow came up with his own way of using that that doesn't use any of that. That's more just him as a magician and a mime, whatever, making this thing work. And so he's amazing. So I ran into him at the Magic Castle.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh, this is great because here I am doing some research onto this stuff. And I sat down and had a conversation with him for about an hour. And it was amazing. It was just sort of kind of a gift to talk to this guy with his resources and then the way he approaches stuff, and then him making some very good points about, well, this works because of this. This works because of that, or that doesn't work because of that. And it got me thinking too about, you know, I have to sit down and say, what do I love about this routine? What, forget about the method, forget about the technology. And the same thing with the story. You say, what do I love about it? And I was talking about another magician who's put a lot of time and effort into a routine. I'm like, okay, you want to make this work. You have to say what you love about it. Start with what you love about it and what you won't give away, and then move from there. And so that's what I've been going through is I've been looking at this thing saying, what do I love here? What do I love? And then what makes it work? And then from like the dancing handkerchief, I was looking at that saying, okay, what makes this – where is it most powerful for the audience? And it's most powerful for an audience, I think, when it's inside of a jug and you think that there are no wires. Magicians may like it when it flies around and all that, but I think people think, you know, even when there aren't, they think, oh, there are wires or this or that. And that's an approach I'm trying to use now to get more to it, is like just write down what's best about something and then figure out another way to get there.
So I'm trying really hard to figure out which book I learned it from. But there's, I want to say it's How to Fly a Horse. If I was going to guess, that may be wrong. I've been really on a bender on, Audible books. Yeah, let's say it's How to Fly a Horse. But he talks a lot about the curse of knowing. How once you know a thing, it's extremely difficult to view any problem through the lens of not knowing. And in magic, yes, we have it very, very bad. And he talks about how, you know, the more creative, the more extraordinary solutions almost always come from the outside. This is why outsiders come in and disrupt entire industries.
Mm-hmm. I've got to, when we're offline, I'm going to show you something and explain. Like, here's a method.
Oh, you know what? Neshcom says it might be made to stick. If that's where you remember it from, Neshcom, then maybe it was made to stick, because I also read that around the same time.
I'll show you something where I go, like, here's this really cool technology that magicians love, yet here's this $1,000 thing, and here's this $15 thing, and tell me which is better. And, you know, and that's what's interesting about that is that we certainly fall in, we get very much in love with our solutions and the knowledge of stuff, and we have to step back. I have a new book I'm writing, and I had one way I wanted to do it, but I was hesitating. I thought, like, well, I came up with this way to do it because I think I have to do this because of what I did before or to make this different. But I said, if I'm not passionate about it, maybe I need to step back and just say, okay, what makes this good? Does the location make it good? No, the location doesn't make it good. And I was going to write it in a foreign country. I'm like, I've never been there. I don't know anything about it. And maybe I need to just change it and then combine it with something else that I love that I never thought about connecting it to.
Yeah. And by the way, it does look like a quick Google search. It appears that they definitely talk about it Made to Stick. So that must be where I heard it from. Made to Stick was fantastic, by the way, as was Contagious. In fact, preemptively, those are my repicks after we already discussed those on Weird Things.
And I think that in following, you know, kind of stepping away from stuff and when you have different bodies of knowledge, you know, I'll put Raymond Crowe's videos would be my pick because here's a guy that he loves, like Charlie Chaplin. He loves sort of old time stuff. And when you watch his performances, he incorporates that. He's got up on his Facebook page. You look at Facebook, he's got a really, actually, go take a look at that.
On his Facebook page? Yeah.
And this is a guy that took several different things that he loves. I think there's a video. We scroll down.
All right. So we're taking a look at a link to one of his past stage shows.
Listeners, just go to the Facebook page for Raymond Crowe, Unusualist.
So it looks like he's pulling out a little ukulele here.
Yeah.
Do we want to listen to this? Or?
Yeah, listen. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And by the way, this I can tell already that this is going to resonate with the advice Teller gave me of have heroes outside of magic. You know, it's like magic doesn't need more magicians who have magicians as heroes.
Excuse me, this might be important.
So he's... pulling over some gear, he's got a ukulele on his back. He's futzing around with some various equipment, all of which looks.
You can turn his audio up so we can hear him.
Yeah, no, it's unfortunately very just poor audio.
It's a gift from the theater. I was here in January with the Illusionist 2.0, and the staff here is so friendly, as you probably discovered when you came in. At the last night we were here, they had a big party for us. And to tell you the truth, I don't even remember what happened at the end of the night.
So the guy is, he's got apparently is a baby from when he was there a year before, right?
Right.
The baby noise is him. He's making that noise
that's
himself.
That's ventriloquism happening right now.
Yeah. Now, you know, he's pulled out a mirror to compare himself. Now, skip ahead. Because what happens is, just where this is going to go is amazing. It's a great thing. He's got a box with presumably a baby we never see. Oh, there we go.
There we go. And so we're seeing like shadowography? Is that
it's a shadow. We see now a shadow. It's like a big circle with a shadow of it. And now it's an entire play playing out in shadows with him acting real time, interacting with little cutout silhouettes.
Oh, this is great. So you could tell from the focus that the silhouettes are at a different focal distance than he is, but he's using mime to interact with all of these objects to make it look like he's leaning on a banister or setting a box on the railing of a porch. That's phenomenal.
He just walked down to the first floor of a building, realized he left the baby on. Again, this is done with him, one bulb, somebody with just moving a silhouette in front of the light bulb, and yet we're watching a movie that involves a several-story building, an airplane now.
Okay, a reference to King Kong. Wow, is that well choreographed.
And this is a guy that's created, you know, this amazing bit of visual magic and delight using, you know, like as you said, his influences are, you know, here, Harold Lloyd, Charlie Chaplin. And it's, you know, when you're in a theater, and I've never seen this live, but you're in a theater watching this, and now...
Oh, that's great. And he's doing individual scenes, like it cuts to a close-up of him hanging on the side of a pole, and then I assume it's him acting out a spider tickling his fingers so that he lets go of the flagpole and falls down.
Yeah, there's no video here. It's just all live.
That's extraordinary. You know, here's the thing, is stuff like this may have seemed, I would say certainly at home in the vaudeville era, possibly aspects of it, cliche in the vaudeville era. But as we enter an age where millennials are going to have a substantially more important hand in deciding, you know, what's popular or not, I suspect that all of a sudden that is the white hot place to get everyone's attention. For example, like people ask me all the time, they're like, where do you get your ideas for Scam School? And we're creeping up on 400 episodes. And weirdly, because I got my start reading everything, there has been friction about like what is and isn't appropriate to put on Scam School. So my solution has been to just go older and older for source materials. And now I find it very, very easy for me to find a book from the 1920s where no one can lay any claim to anything on it and use that as inspiration and figure out a way to present it in a 21st century appropriate environment. And to me, this is no more difficult than learning my first tricks when, you know, 20 years ago. And yet, to anyone under the age of 25, when they're like, where can I get original ideas? I say, at the library. You can read a book and be inspired by it. It's as though I'm telling them to go to Mars. You know, all you got to do is fly over to Mars and grab yourself some ideas. And I suspect that's just going to be more and more. That is the ability to research in a boring, tedious format is going to be a more and more valuable commodity in the next 10 to 15 years.
For sure. I know that, you know, going to, in this case, what I've been working on, going to the library, I'm going to go there in an hour or two, go back there to go do some more research on stuff. It gives you a wide variety of stuff and then sit down. I'm lucky that I can go talk to experts and people like this who know this. There's a guy I'm going to try to go talk to tonight who is a performer in the castle who is the chief puppeteer for Team America.
Wow.
So, you know, but, you know, in your own case, you can find these different ways to do this research on stuff, but ask a lot of questions. And that's my frustration from it. Like, I have friends who perform at the castle and I'll watch them go do a trick. And I'm like, wow, it's a great trick. It's a wonderful trick. Everybody does this trick. I would probably do this trick in a corporate show, but you're at the castle. You've got the most amazing amount of resources in the world that you could hope for to find material. You go into that library, you grab 5 books off the shelf, you find something just as good or better that's not been seen in 50 years. But we were cautious. We want to go with what we've seen, what's worked, and we will often make that choice to do what everybody else has done because at least we know that works. And that's often we tell people to be original. We forget about that. But then the solution is, how do you make that work? How do you find a place?
That's the funny part is that strangely we tell people to be original, but we don't mean that at all, because original implies that you're creating in a vacuum. What we're saying is draw from influences outside of what's currently popular or what's currently, you know, in the metagame of your discipline, of your art, draw from outside that. So we're essentially saying the words be original, but by original we mean, you know, copy and remix something farther outside your current sphere.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that anytime you put two things together that haven't been together, that's pretty original.
Absolutely.
And I would say there is this in the copy remix culture. There has been this sort of almost a dismissive attitude, like, well, and it's not you, but there is this, well, nothing's original. It's like, well.
But oftentimes the problem is that's oftentimes justification to borrow something that's currently popular in
you know, like, listen,
or from 10
you know,
years
yeah.
ago or whatever.
And that gets to be like, listen.
I agree. That is bogus.
We saw what Raymond Crowe just do with the shadows and that. Like, yeah, I mean, that thing may have been done like 80 years ago, but he created an original little playette to do with this and do that. And it's so much more rewarding. But the problem is, like, how do you make it good, or how do you do that? And I've been picking up a lot of little fun magic here, and it's like, great. I need to find places to go do this, you know, where nobody cares that, you know, I'm the guy from TV failing at something because, you know.
That's the thing, man. You got to find a safe space to be bad. And it's harder and harder. And it's like, even though nobody's watching at the moment that you're originally trying it, you also have to recognize it's on the record forever. And then if you become super famous for this act, that footage of you trying it and doing it badly will suddenly become extraordinarily valuable and precious, the way we felt about the bootlegs of the Beatles or Bob Dylan.
Yeah, I just think that magic's different. Magic is you don't, if your goal is to be a magician, you don't want to have video of you being bad at it out there.
I mean, certainly I don't think you want video of you being bad at music either out there or bad at stand-up comedy.
Yeah, but we understand the growth in music. Everybody sits down at a piano and knows this is where they start, where they end up, and we're magic where the technique is supposed to be invisible or is supposed to be hidden.
I don't know that. I mean, certainly you won't be fooled when you watch a bad magic act, but also when you watch bad comedy eventually evolve into good comedy, you don't laugh. I mean, it's short of the dividing line. I mean, that's the reason that Patton Oswalt went on a tear against that one person who thought they were doing him a favor, you know, bootlegging his set that he was still ironing out on. You know what I mean?
I missed, what was the first part?
Oh, I was going to say I would liken it to comedy acts, because comedy acts, up to a certain point, they're just not funny, and then they cross that line, and then they become polished and well enough that they become funny.
I have, like, in me, I think magic, there's a part of the wall that I do not like to, in my form of presentation, I don't like to show. I don't like to say, let's go behind her and go look at this, because it becomes less interesting. And that's my, you know, that's the way I approach things. And I've turned down stuff in magic and shows that I thought were done really well. But I go, no, this show gets into process. And I don't want to get into that part of process, because it's not as, you know, magician is inherently interesting sort of person. You know, like you take a show like Penn and Teller Fool Us. David Copperfield probably would not be a judge on a show like that, because David Copperfield is supposed to be the greatest magician of all time, and arguably is.
Right.
He's not going to put himself in a position where he's going to see somebody perform and then say, I don't know.
You fooled me. Yes. Whereas
personally, he would tell you. He would have, oh, that's great, that's wonderful, whatever. But the persona probably is never going to be like,
capital D, capital C. Whereas, you know, Penn and Teller, their brand and their personality is very iterative, and they certainly have, you know.
But I know of, you know, from prior thing, I know people who've been on there and fooled them, and they would not admit it.
Oh, what do you mean? Oh, Penn and Teller wouldn't admit it?
Yeah, they're like, oh yeah, no, like, what, you know, but they didn't know. They, you know, that was what's funny. It's like, I know of a couple instances like that where like, oh, it's this thing or whatever, and it's like, you know, so.
Well, you know, and they've been open about a lot of that stuff. You hear about the stories of Penn has talked on his podcast about the stories of, like, they think they know, and then Johnny Thompson has to explain, like, nope, sorry, boys.
Yeah.
I'm the judge, and I say you didn't get it.
Yeah. But anyhow, I mean, yeah, and it's because it's we all fall into that. Oh, I know this. And then it's a delightful thing when you go, oh, wow.
Yeah, dude, I, you know what? Made to stick, man. Talk about the curse of knowledge. Here's the quote that I really dug from Made to Stick. Quote, and that brings us to the villain of our book, The Curse of Knowledge. Lots of research in economics and psychology shows that when we know something, it becomes hard for us to imagine not knowing it. As a result, we become lousy communicators. Think of a lawyer who can't give you a straight, comprehensible answer to a legal question. His vast knowledge and experience renders him unable to fathom how little you know. So when he talks to you, he talks in abstractions that you can't follow. And we're all like the lawyer in our own domain of expertise. And I absolutely agree with it.
Yep.
Man, I gotta run, unfortunately. It's gonna have to be a short after things.
Sir, well, it was a pleasure.
It's been after.
Thanks.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.